The meeting is rapidly coming to a close, and I always have mixed feelings about how quickly the week goes from the standpoint of being away from home. I don't mind it. But from the standpoint of being involved in the meeting, I hate to see it come to an end. I've enjoyed being over here and look forward to yet one more evening with you as we search together from the Word of God. Good once again tonight to see some people that I have known in years past who have listened to me patiently on several occasions, and they chose to come do that again. It's sure nice to see Rosella, and it's not too bad even to see Lloyd. Seems like you can't see her without seeing him, so that's the way it goes. But I appreciate them. The several folks from New Lebanon have been there this week. New Carlisle people have been here. Huber Heights people have been here. And I suppose Haines Street, so I hope I haven't left anybody out, but I've done some preaching in all of those places, and it's really good to see you. Appreciate you coming, and I know that everyone else does as well. One of the things that most of us dread, especially during the middle of the night, is to hear a phone ring. We almost automatically assume, and unfortunately a lot of times it's true, that there's some bad news on the other end of that line. It doesn't always come in the middle of the night. I'll probably never forget the phone call that I got from my younger sister, who called to tell me on a Friday that our dad was not doing very well at all. Now, it happened that he lived over 2 weeks after that, but I'll never forget that call because it, of course, has really made a difference in my life and the events that have taken place since then, and many of you can identify with that. I don't want to get calls like that. Nobody does, but it happens. And we receive word then of someone seriously ill, or perhaps someone has already passed from this life. Sometimes we receive phone calls about other members of the family. Their health is all right, but they're not getting along. They're fussing, they're feuding, or some such thing as that. And we don't like to get those calls either, because that means there's trouble at home, and that's our subject for tonight, trouble at home. It isn't any secret. I've mentioned some of these things in other lessons this week, and I'm going to try not to have some overlap, but there are other things affecting the family that I haven't talked about, and I want to cover those tonight. So parts of my lesson as I look over it here that I have already touched on, I won't cover as heavily so that I can cover some other things that I think need to be said. But I have mentioned that the family, as far as marriage is concerned, when we talked on marriage and divorce, that marriages are breaking up at about a 50% rate. About one out of every two marriages ends in divorce. Many people think that they didn't make a very good choice the first time, but I'll do a better job next time. And they go out and find the one they believe to be the right person, only to find out to be a part of a statistic that basically says 75% of second marriages do not last. And so some people just don't seem to make a very good choice. Now, as a lot of people view that, and they know people in their family to whom that's happened, or they got friends that have gone through that, and they decide that there's another alternative. It's quite popular in our country for people to reject the commitment of marriage and the terrible pain that seems to be caused when that marriage dissolves and opt in favor of living together. They reason that it won't be as bad then if we have to dissolve this relationship. It won't be as bad as if we were married. Well, they have found out through their studies and talking with people who've decided upon that option that really they go through the same emotional trauma that people do who have already married and then go through a divorce process. Now, it might be cheaper. They can just walk away. There's no divorce proceedings. Very often, children are already involved, and so there's still custody to consider. There's still the matter of child support to be considered, and all these things remain the same no matter what route one goes. But the emotional trauma is just about the same. And so really you aren't going to escape some of the terrible consequences of a marriage relationship or of a live-in arrangement by just going for the latter and not the former. It's not going to happen. You're going to have to deal with that. Either way, back in 1960, in that time, as I mentioned the other night, when we were told that such programs as Leave It to Beaver and things like that really did not represent the average American home, and I would take issue with that. But back in 1960, only 9% of children lived with one parent. You know, that's not very many. And of course, many of them live with one parent simply because their mother or their father had died. So some of them can be accounted for in that kind of arrangement. Well, you know, that's greatly multiplied by now. That's no secret to any of us here. So that now we've got a much higher percentage than that. It's gone clear from 9% to about 24 or 5% of children are now living with just one parent, and the vast majority of the increase is not due to a higher rate of death among the parent, but rather, of course, the divorce rate has increased. That's the problem. I want to look at some of these statistics with you just to maybe make an impact a little bit on the situation we're talking about. The largest share, it says, 42%, were children of divorced parents out of this group of youngsters they were studying. 27% were children of parents who had never married. 24% had parents who were married but separated. And 7% were offspring of a widowed parent. So again, this alarming number of increase of children who are in an inferior living arrangement most of the time because of a single parent home. There's exceptions to that, I understand that. But most of the time, they are not in that circumstance because of the death of the parent. In fact, as it says here, only 7% of them. 42 because of the matter of divorce. 27 because their parents never bothered to get married. That's pathetic. The illegitimate race in our country, of course, has increased dramatically over the last few years. And this has gone on when we're told by all the experts that it doesn't matter whether you marry or not. And it doesn't have any effect on children. They're able to handle all of that. Well, they aren't, because it runs counter to what God has had in mind. So these statistics are alarming. And then there's the fact that some couples will stay together, but they're not very happy. But they sometimes do stay together for sake of the children. And all the while this is going on, the children, of course, are caught in the middle. Why is this happening? What's going on? Why is there trouble at home? And I would suggest to you, in the first place, the foundation of the family is weak. And it's weakened to some extent by the efforts of the feminists who set out, really, as some of these quotes that I'll talk about, they set out, really, to do what they could to bring down the family, to try to convince women to choose a career instead of family, that it wasn't very fulfilling to just be at home with your children. You're not as important. You're not making a statement if all you do is stay home with your children. Go ahead and have children, but don't let it get in the way of your career. Find a good daycare center to put them in. And it's amazing when you hear stories about people in those circumstances, and they describe how that the first time they take their son or daughter or both, their children, over to that daycare center, they talk about how their children just screamed and cried and they didn't want to be left there. And they say, it just about tore my heart out. I couldn't hardly stand it. But, you know, the next day, they didn't cry as much, and by the end of the week, they actually weren't crying at all when I left them there and went to work. And they interpret that as a sign that the kids decided they liked it there. I think there's another possibility. The kids realize there's no use to cry. They're going to leave me here anyway. That's probably really what's going on in the minds of some of these children. And that's terrible. And so to overcome the guilt that some of these women feel when they leave their children like that, they conduct seminars. They had one several years ago, not too far from where I was living in Joliet. I didn't go to it, of course. It's for women on balancing career and home. But I did get a flyer about an announcement of the speakers that were going to be there and some of the topics they were going to cover. Think of this one here, making child care worry-free. And as subtitles, ways to take the sting out of the separation anxiety. How many of you parents, maybe you mothers especially, are ever completely comfortable when your children are out of your sight? There's always that little doubt up there. Well, I wonder if they're safe. And you look out in the yard, they're playing all right. You go back to your work there somewhere, and all of a sudden you hear some tires that are screeching. You run over to see if it's your children that might be in danger, but just go to this seminar and why, they'll tell you how you can be separated from your children all day and not even have any anxiety about it. Isn't that something? Guidelines for selecting daycare that you and your child will feel comfortable with. Children feel comfortable with the care they get from their parents. They don't really like daycare if they had a real choice. Here's a section on maintaining a professional image on the job. In other words, mothers, don't act like a mother when you're at work. Don't let anybody know that you're concerned about your children. Don't let them think you love them. And don't let that interfere with your work. How to avoid common mistakes working mothers make that may tarnish their professional image. Well, above all things, don't tarnish your professional image by making a phone call to the daycare center to see how your children are doing. How to separate work life from your home life and handle the responsibilities of both like a pro. I haven't seen too many women able to do that. And I've talked to them about it, and they said, you can't do all of that. It's just too hard. There's too much there. Developing a positive mindset. How to handle working parents' guilt. Well, they shouldn't feel any guilt. The feminists have told us that they're more fulfilled when they're out there chasing a career. Well, it's not so. And it is good to report from time to time. You'll see studies done of women who have decided, wait a minute, corporate America is not where it's at. I'm going home. I'm having children. I'm staying there with them. So they are, to some extent, turning their back on the advice of the feminists, and they're going home to be with their children. Well, a lot of people don't have any problem with their children in daycare because they abort them once they find out that they are on the way. After all, it will interfere with their career. And they're not going to have that because they've bought into the feminist line that you've got to have a career in order to find a fulfillment. And so, we've got these problems out there that undermine the foundation of the family. Just to give you an idea that I didn't make a lot of this up about the attitudes of feminists, actually not just toward working and careers, but toward marriage in general, here's what some of them say, taken from feminist documents. Marriage has existed for the benefit of men and has been a legally sanctioned method of control over women. Married woman is expected to be the domestic slave of her husband, often stated in the marriage ceremony, the wife shall be subject to her husband. I got news for these feminists. That wasn't invented by some preacher. That comes out of the Word of God. It's her duty to cook his meals, wash his clothes, clean his house, and raise his kids. She receives no salary for this work. She's expected to be subservient to him, to obey his requests and orders. He is king of his castle. Now, they just really despise men when you get right down to it. The end of the institution of marriage is a necessary condition for the liberation of women. Well, I got all kinds of. Here's Gloria Steinem. For the sake of those who wish to live in equal partnership, we have to abolish and reform the institution of marriage. You ever wonder why you see women now with hyphenated names? Listen to this. Resolve that the woman should be able to keep her own name, or the husband to take his wife's name, or there should be the option of both partners choosing a neutral second name. That's where this is coming from in society. So ladies, you know, think about that. I've known some of the women in the church to hyphenate their name, you know, keep their maiden name, take their husband's name, put a hyphen between them. This is where it come from, folks. This come from the feminists. I wouldn't want to be lined up with them in any way, shape, or form on things like that. Well, you know, on and on we could go, but I'm not going to keep on reading those things. Just don't buy into. One other thing I do want to read here, this final one. Don't buy into this. There's nothing to that. Within the structure of the nuclear family, children are oppressed because they are defined as property. We support parent-controlled child care centers as a necessary step toward the feminist socialist revolution. With the destruction of the nuclear family must come a new way of looking at children. They must be seen as the responsibility of an entire society rather than individual parents. Let me put it another way. As our present First Lady said and wrote a book about it, it takes a village. Don't make any mistake about it. These people who believe this are in high positions in our country, in government and in educational institutions, and they are promoting this and they're bombarding our children with this. We can't really preach and teach enough about the family, because when our children go away to college especially, and depending on the courses they take, they're going to get hit with this all the time. And it will be tough for them to sit there among their peers and maybe be the only one that disagrees with it. Because if they raise their hand and voice their disagreement, they'll be ridiculed. They're going to need to be strong and grounded in what the Word of God has to say about these matters. So let's equip them to handle those things when it comes, because it will come. And of course, the Bible is where we get the proper model for the family. We talked about that Tuesday night on the subject of marriage and divorce and remarriage. And it begins with marriage. God saw that it was not good for man to be alone in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 18. Man didn't have a companion. Adam had named all the others. They were paired off and Adam gave them names. Adam's left over by himself. There is no companion for Adam. God saw that that wasn't good. Adam was alone, and so he created a helpmeet for him. A suitable companion, the New American Standard says. One that was answerable to his needs. Perfectly suited for the needs of man. Women, you need to take heart in that. The crowning act of God's creative powers was woman. That's it. The one thing that was missing, and by, of course, God said he looked over his creation and saw that it was good. And it was in every realm, except he created man and looked at man and said, it's not good that he's alone, and created woman for him. Now that ought to tell us men something. We cannot and dare not and must not treat our wives like they're a doormat. That may have given rise to some of these feminists that seem to hate men. But the Bible, of course, teaches us about the family and tells us you've got a husband, a wife, they're in the home, they're taking care of their children, they're providing the spiritual direction for their children, they love each other, they love their children, they don't contemplate divorce. Matthew chapter 19 and verse 9, as we studied Tuesday night, whosoever divorces, therefore divorces his wife and marries another, commits adultery, and whoever marries the one that is divorced commits adultery. That's what God said about it, one exception. And their roles, as we looked at, were set by God in his word, Ephesians chapter 5 and other places. And children are the responsibility of parents, not society. My oldest son had a fifth grade teacher that didn't quite understand that concept. We found out, because he was willing to talk to us about it, that there were times in that classroom when she would say, now children, we're family right here. And she would deliberately talk to them about things and tell them, now don't go home and tell your parents. We're going to keep this here within the family. We had a conference with her. Well, she said, I just think of those kids as my children. I said, they're not your children. That's my son, our son. Jane was there. That's our son, and we're going to make decisions, and we don't appreciate all this secrecy going on here in the classroom. Well, you know, she didn't much like that discussion and was trying to argue way out of it until my wife is very thorough. I mean, she keeps track of me and everything else. She pulled out her list, and she had dates and times that she'd talk with her. She documented things, and that pretty well is the end of that argument. That even embarrassed the principal. He just almost had to do something. Listen, folks, this is going on out there. They will try, if they can, to get away with really swaying the mind of your children. Your job is to not let that happen. Well, family life is in trouble, and we want to look at some of the reasons why. There's a lack of communication in a lot of homes. In fact, the matter is, I have to confess that sometimes when I'm away like this from home, probably in a week's time, I will end up talking to Jane more in total number of minutes than I do when I'm home. Now, that's so because I get busy at home. There's many other things going on. And here, when you're away for a meeting, you're staying in somebody's home, you know, and you stay at somebody like Keith. I mean, Rita's there to talk to, but, well, you know, there's a certain amount of free time. Yeah, I'm just picking on Keith. He understands that. We've had a great week together. I've enjoyed it. But you got a certain amount more free time, and so you end up calling home and talking and seeing how things are going and kind of going on and on and on. And it has even occurred to us at times that, boy, we're talking about stuff that we needed to be talking about at home. We get busy, and we don't communicate like we should. We get tired. I'm just too tired to talk. I'll talk to you about it tomorrow. And when this lack of communication goes on for a long time, then pretty soon you don't have very much in common. And your marriage becomes weaker and weaker. In fact, after a while, the only thing that some married couples have in common is that they can't stand each other. That's the one thing they have in common. I can't stand you. And she said, well, I can't stand you either. And they don't try to remedy it in any way. They just go on like that. Isn't that terrible? Like a fellow says, my wife is a rose. I feel the thorns daily. That's how some men feel. Well, my wife is an angel. She's always harping on something. You ever hear any of those? And most of the time we say those in a joking way, but there are men who feel like that. The only time their wife communicates with them is when she wants to complain about something. But it works both ways. Sometimes men give occasion for complaint by the way they treat their wives. The Bible teaches us a lot about communication. It tells us, of course, how to control our speech, that we must control what we say. Certainly not to tell lies, but we're certainly to speak those things that are good for the other person. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 29, for example. Let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth, but only such a word as is good for edification, according to the need of the moment, that it may give grace to those who hear. That has broad application in every circumstance where we try to communicate. We should be trying to communicate in words that are going to help that other person. Well, that includes our wife or our husband, as well as it would anybody else. Let your speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt. Over in the book of Colossians, chapter 4, verse 6, so that you may know how you should respond to each person. Doesn't that apply to our wife or our husband? As we talked about last night, there's a wrong and a right way to communicate with our spouse, to go the second mile with them. Lack of communication, it's a big problem in marriages, and it causes trouble at home. But there's a lack of discipline in the home where there are children involved. Someone said, you know, everything in a house is controlled by a switch in our modern age, except the children. You ever seen kids like that? I saw one today at lunch. I thought the kid's going to tear the blinds down at Ryan's. He just had them all bent up and all messed up. And parents would, they looked over at him, saw what he was doing, just kept on. Didn't say a word to him. He needed a little lesson, but he didn't get it. I don't know what they do with him generally, but he wasn't getting the attention he needed today. And in fact, that's why he was doing it. I think they were ignoring him. He wanted to get their attention. Well, when my sons did something like that, they got my attention. They didn't want it after they got it, but they got it. There was a story of a woman in a grocery store. She was overheard by another customer saying, all right, just be calm. Just be calm. Her kid was just screaming her head off. Just be calm. hold it down. And this person says, I'm just amazed at how well you're handling your child there and how you're trying to deal with them and get them to calm down and talk to them softly like that. She says, I'm not talking to my child, I'm talking to myself. She's about ready to go ballistic with the child. Well, you know, there's no discipline anymore. We're seeing the effects of permissiveness, as was promoted several years ago by Dr. Spock. He just passed away here not that long ago. He helped to ruin a lot of homes by people following his advice. They shouldn't have followed his advice. It wasn't altogether his fault. But he believed in a real permissive way of child rearing. Doesn't work. We know it doesn't work because of what the Bible says. In the book of Proverbs, the 13th chapter, starting out, we'll just go through Proverbs here and notice a few verses. Proverbs 13:24. He who spares his rod hates his son. He who loves him disciplines him diligently. You know, in a lot of places you get in trouble if you use the rod on your child. He goes back to school and the teacher notices that it looks like he's been physically punished, and you can be hauled before the authorities. You may even be put in jail for spanking your children. It's happened. They equate that with child abuse. Well, I don't advocate child abuse. That's wrong. But spanking a child and applying the Board of Education at the seat of learning never hurt anybody. In fact, it's helped a whole lot of us. I received some of that when I was growing up. Proverbs chapter 19, verse 18. The writer says, discipline your son while there is hope, and do not desire his death. We're not talking about child abuse. We're not talking about beating a child to the point of death. That's wrong. Things like that ought to be prosecuted. But merely using the rod of discipline on your child is not wrong. It's sanctioned by God, whether the experts want to believe it or not. In chapter 22, and of course verse 6, very familiar, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. There are some basic things we need to instill in our children to help build character in them. Later on in chapter 6 and verse 22, verse 15, foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. The rod of discipline will remove it far from him. Boy, that's true. I can attest to that. Can you? You get into some foolishness when you're a child. Doesn't seem like foolishness to mom and dad, and you know they can put that foolishness out of there quick. Now, what's the point of all of that? They're trying to help you mature and trying to help you make right decisions. And when you make a wrong decision, they're going to tell you about it. 23rd chapter, verse 13, do not hold back discipline from the child. Although you beat him with the rod, he will not die. You shall beat him with the rod and deliver his soul from Sheol. Don't kill him. Not the point. Don't abuse him, but use the rod when necessary. Chapter 29 and verse 15. The rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child who gets his own way brings shame to his mother. I would hate for my mother to be ashamed of me. That must be a terrible thing. I know parents who are ashamed of their children because of the way they've turned out. It must be terrible. Kids, don't ever do anything that would make your parents ashamed of you. In fact, as you grow older, begin to do what's right for that very reason. As you grow older, hopefully you will begin to realize that I need to do the right thing, not just because mom and dad have a right to tell me to do the right thing, but because I don't want to break their heart. And that's what it does to your mom and dad, I'll tell you right now. When they see you go in the wrong direction, and maybe especially when you have to suffer some very painful consequences, they would almost wish they could suffer them for you, but they can't. And it just rips their heart out. And so conduct yourself in such a way that your mom and your dad are never, ever ashamed of you. Don't ever let that happen. Verse 17 says, correct your son and he will give you comfort. He will also delight your soul. Live in such a way that your parents enjoy having you around and they're proud of you, but they never really have to brag on you because other people do it. And parents, it's much better if we'll let other people brag on our children than for us to go around them. People get tired of that real quick. It's a whole lot better when other people are able to say some good things about your children But it'll only be that way if you do the right training. The book of Hebrews in the New Testament, it talks about in the 12th chapter the matter of chastening, correcting, and compares the relationship that we have with our children to that of God and His children. And the idea here is that just as God disciplines us for our own good, our parents discipline us for our good. God disciplines us because He loves us. We, therefore, are to chasten or discipline our children for the same reason, because we love them. In verse 7, for example, of Hebrews 12, it's for discipline that you endure. God deals with you as with sons. What son is there whom his father does not discipline? And if you are without discipline, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Most of us discipline our children. We don't take in hand unless circumstances make it necessary to try to discipline other people's children. Sometimes we have to. But we discipline our own children. And it's a sign that those children belong to us. Those don't, we don't discipline them. Generally, they're not ours. We discipline ours because they do belong to us. We have responsibility for them. No discipline, or all of it, he says in verse 11, seems not to be joyful but sorrowful. Well, all of us by experience know that's true. I never enjoyed a single spanking that I got. I can't remember a single one that I liked. And I have an idea, if I would have even smiled and gave Dad an idea that it wasn't really hurting me, I could have remembered it even more. No, I didn't even think of smiling. It hurt. It hurt, but look what it says. Yet to those who've been trained by it, afterwards it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. That's the goal. That's why your parents are going to discipline you. And that's not the only form of discipline, of course, that they can use. And sometimes other things are called for. Trouble at home, lack of discipline. But here's another problem. Covetousness. This is that desire to give ourselves and our children just everything they want. You can sort of excuse that in the children. The world is a fascinating place. There's so much out there, and I want one of these, and I want one of these, like going in a toy store. I want one of them. Give me one of them. I want one of everything. Well, there's a limit to what you can give them. But some of us reason that since I didn't have those things, I don't want my kids to go without them. That's a dangerous way to look at things. They don't have to have everything their little old heart desires. They don't have to wear the latest fashions and have all the latest toys. They just might need to learn the lesson that is hard for us to learn. Depend upon God and put our trust in God and not think that we'll have happiness and security with everything we can go out and buy. Of course, Matthew, the 6th chapter, has a lot to say about that. And verse 33 is probably maybe the most familiar verse out of that whole text. Seek ye first the kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. Make that be the philosophy by which you live your life, that the kingdom of God and service to God is first, and everything else will just fall into proper place. One of the greatest lessons I ever got from my parents, but especially, I suppose, my dad, being how he was sort of in charge of the family, and we knew that, and was the head of the house. He lived by that. If I can do a little bragging, he lived by that. I saw a number of times when there was bills left over at the end of the month, and Mom would be concerned, how are we going to pay those? I mean, I don't know why they had so many bills. There was only 7 of us kids. How are we going to get all those paid? What are we going to do? Where are we going to borrow the money? I mean, I saw a time when they borrow money from one loan company and make a payment at another. Seek ye first the kingdom. I've heard him say it to her. Seek ye first the kingdom of heaven. You seek the kingdom first, and God will take care of us. And you know, he always did. We always had stuff to eat and clothes to wear and a place to live all my life. But if we just, whenever they want something, go out and get it, we're really not teaching them to depend upon God. We're teaching them that life will just bring you everything you want. And we're teaching them that you look out there in the world and whatever you see the world has, you need to have the same thing. Covetousness is a sin, of course. And a man's life is not measured by the abundance of that which he possesses. Luke chapter 12 and verse 15, as Jesus talked there about the rich man who says, I've got more goods than my barns will hold. I'm going to have to tear down my barns, build bigger barns. This kind of leads into this next point. I'll tie them together. There's trouble at home because we are conforming to the world too much. And some of it gets started in this area that I just talked about. Our children come home and they say, well, I've got to have a new pair of jeans. Well, what's wrong with the pair that I got you last month? Well, they're not wearing that brand anymore. Those are out of style already. No, none of the kids wear those anymore. They're wearing this brand now. Well, you know, that kind of sounds strange to us parents because we're used to wearing the brands from Kmart anyway. You know, you can't afford to buy the top brands for yourself and your kids, so you wear the Kmart brands and they wear the better brands. You know how that goes. Well, so we go ahead and say, well, all right, I guess, here's the money, you know. Take you probably $40 or $50 to buy a pair of jeans anymore, depending on what kind of brand it is. Maybe more, I don't know. Jane does most of that shopping. What happens is we are developing a mindset that says, when I look out at the world, I want to be like them. I want to have the same brand on my clothing as they do. And you know, that's really not wrong in and of itself. We don't have to, because the world wears a certain brand, go out and buy a different one to show that we're not like the world. That's not the point. But we begin to develop a way of thinking that says, if the world is doing that, I want to do it. And in buying jeans, so long as they're not skin tight or things like that, it doesn't hurt to imitate the world if you can afford it, if you can keep up with it. But the trouble is, after a while, we are so in tune to thinking, I want to be like the world, that we go ahead and conform to them in other ways too. And that's when we get into trouble. Because in those other ways that involve us in sin, we're not to be like the world. Be not conformed to this world, Paul wrote to the Romans, chapter 12, verse 2. But be transformed by the renewing of your minds, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Start in mind, Paul says, in your mind, and you start thinking a different way. Don't be conformed to the world, beginning in your mind and filtering on down to your actions and your deeds, your words. You be different when you have to be different. And don't be different just to be different. That's the mistake that the Amish people make and others like that. They think that somehow there's virtue in dressing entirely different from the rest of the world. Now, we'll have to say what they wear is modest. That's certainly good. But there is no virtue in and of itself to just be different from the world so that people can see that you're different. Well, we'll be different, all right, if we apply godly principles of modesty to the clothing that we choose and we keep our bodies covered. We'll be different. We won't have to really try to be different. We'll just end up being different when we try to live godly lives and try to dress modestly and talk in proper ways and all that. But we end up being conformed to the world. And parents, some of this is our fault. When our children come home and they say, you know, Johnny asked me to go to the prom. He's the neatest kid in school. That's probably not the right word. They don't say neat anymore. I can't keep up with the newest words. I just got to say yes. I've just got to go with him. I mean, all these other girls, they die to go out with him, and he chose me. He wants me to go to the homecoming dance with him. And you know, there's parents that are spineless enough to say, well, okay, I guess you can. Now, parents, don't wimp out like that. That's no place for your child to be. Don't let them go. Now, they're, of course, going to act like the end of the world just around the corner. And that they just can't turn down that boy. I mean, after all, he's the most handsome kid in the whole school. You just learn to say no to them, because you know better than they do about such things as that. So you don't let them go to places like that. They don't have any business going there, and you're the one who has to put the brakes on them. They're not mature enough to do that. That's your job. God put us in charge of them until they got to a sufficient age when they can leave father and mother and go cleave to another person. Then they make their own decision. Then you keep your nose out of it. But while they're at home, you keep your nose in it. And you make the tough choices for them. And you don't let them go to parties over here where there's not going to be adult supervision. You don't let them go. Doesn't matter if everybody that's important in school is going to be there. You just say, no, you're not going. Now, you might say, I tell you what, why don't you have some of your friends over here? Well, none of my friends want to come over here. Well, then get you some different friends then. You got the wrong friends. That's how you care some of that. Don't conform to the world, and parents, don't let them do it, because we can control some of that. And there's just a general lack of commitment to the family. Someone said everybody's on a shift system. Dad, he's on the night shift, mom's on the day shift, and the kids have to shift for themselves. And that's about the way it is. There's really no supervision. Nobody really committed to that family being what it should be, being what God wants it to be. And that's why I said God's first. Matthew 6, verse 33. Let God be first in that family. Let that mother and father place a premium on their relationship. Sometimes parents end up devoting themselves to their children and neglecting their spouse. God does not intend for that to happen. That's wrong. I've had my boys once in a while over the years complain that they want my attention. So, well, how comes you can't do this with us? I said, well, I already got something I'm going to do with your mom. And I just tell them, she's here first. She's around here before you were. So I'm going to give her some attention. You're not going to get that right now. Make a commitment that this home is going to be what it ought to be. And then devote yourself to each other in these various relationships within the family. Make that commitment to God. Joshua chapter 24 and verse 15 perhaps said it best. As for me and my house, we will serve Jehovah. We will serve Jehovah. There's a story told of a young man who decided that he didn't want to be under the authority of his parents. He didn't want to obey them and didn't want to be faithful to God anymore, and so he became unfaithful. They had that on a plaque above their door. And his dad went up there where it said, as for me and my house, we will serve Jehovah. And he put, except Tom. And that boy had to see that every time he came in there. He looked up there and saw that, and it finally worked on him, and he straightened things up. That's our job, parents, to try to avoid trouble at home. If you're here tonight and you're not a child of God, we would plead with you to become one. Begin to dedicate your life to God, and then you'll be in a proper position when it comes time for you to have a family, if you don't have one yet, to set an example before them. And they can grow up being interested in serving God. And if you've already done that, made a commitment to God, but you have gone back on your commitment, sin has entered your life, then we would plead with you to make that right with God this very hour while we stand and we sing together.